Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Reed-Sheridan, standing in for Josh Fennett, who's back in Singapore this week on the pretense of business. On today's show, we're turning our attention to the crossroads where film meets with design and architecture. First up,
you actually see how people relate to the environment, how they interact with the environment, and why they start at certain points to attach themselves to particular environmental features.
We speak to Chad Fredericks, the director of a documentary film about the Pruitt-Igoe public housing complex in St. Louis, Missouri. Next, Monocle's resident film buff Ben Ryman gives us his take on the art of the cinematic title sequence. Then,
we saw different patterns in different sizes, so not only the screen is illuminated, also the cinema space.
Alexei Korolev pays a visit to an exhibition at Vienna Design Week that asks visitors to interact with the cinema as a design object. And finally, we get ARC Daily editor James Taylor Foster's take on how filmmakers use architecture and how architects use film. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show.
We begin with a scene 1 meter wide, which we view from just 1 meter away. Now, every 10 seconds, we will look from 10 times farther away, and our field of view will be 10 times wider.
A clip there from the famous short, Powers of Ten, written and directed by the designers Charles and Ray Eames. For decades, designers have used film to explore and document their ideas, and in turn, filmmakers have incorporated design and architecture as integral components of their work to create atmosphere and drive narrative. We're going to begin today's show by talking to film director Chad Fredericks. He's a director of the Pruitt-Igoe Myth. The film is a documentary looking at the history of the Pruitt-Igoe public housing complex in St. Louis, Missouri. It draws on archive footage and interviews with former residents to document the decline of social conditions within the complex, leading to its eventual destruction in 1976. I began by asking Chad what makes film a good medium for exploring architecture.
Well, I think it can be a good medium. It depends on many aspects of the director's approach. So let me give you an example that I really like. It's a film called The Social Life of Small Urban Spaces. It's by William H. White, and it's from the 1960s. It analyzes a series of plazas in New York City and attempts to define what makes a good plaza, what makes a plaza work. Why do some people avoid certain parts of plazas and glom onto other kinds of plazas? And there are these shots in this film where you actually see people moving about within this plaza. They're shot at kind of a high frame rate, or actually a slower frame rate. So you kind of get a sense of how people are moving around over the course of time. And you have a little clock down in the bottom corner of the screen that gives you a sense of the time that's passing. And one of the really cool things about this film is you actually see how people relate to the environment, how they interact with the environment, and why they start at certain points to attach themselves to particular environmental features of these plazas. And so kind of general rules are extracted by the filmmaker by these recordings. And they're just really great films to watch. They have all sorts of different shots, but the ones that are most interesting to me are these wide angle shots that really kind of give you an observational sense of how this space works. That's an example of a film that I think can work really, really well architecturally because it gives you a sense of the functioning of a space, right? I think you have many aspects to a film that can kind of create a sense of space, obviously imagery, right? If we're just looking at architectural just as kind of an aesthetic experience, the visuals work really well with film's capacity to present visuals, the visual design of a space, the shapes, the lines, the negative space, and how lighting can impact a space. And then you have sound and music and all these other kind of things that create a sense of the emotion as well as potentially reinterpret a space, you know, give a space a new meaning, especially with music. And then finally, you have editing, which can, you know, jump from a very kind of tight, compact area to immediately a very wide shot. It gives you a sense of juxtaposing certain areas. You know, it gives you a sense of, you know, how there's small spaces as well as live spaces that exist coterminously within this space, right? And so those kinds of features, I think, allow for not only a kind of intellectual interrogation of a space like William H. White was doing in that film, but it also allows you a sense of like how that space actually feels, how one might interpret it if we were there ourselves.
And Chad, what attracted you to the Pruitt-Igoe complex as a subject for a documentary film? And what did you hope to achieve through the film?
Well, I think this is a really good example of how a project changes over time. So actually, let me start at the very beginning before I even had a project. My wife and I had bought a home back in 2007, and we were decorating our home in mid-century style. It was a 1950s ranch, and so we were going to kind of embrace the more dated features of the structure. And so we started buying up furniture from the mid-1950s, going to various antique malls and whatnot. And in the process of that, I began researching modernist architecture, modernist design, modernist furniture. While I was doing that research, Pruitt-Igoe came up. And Pruitt-Igoe was kind of brought up as this, what happens when things go wrong with modernism kind of story. It was, you know, famously by Charles Jenks called the failure of modern architecture, the final death blow to modern architecture. And so, wow, this is a big idea, you know. And so, like, what had started out as a furniture shopping spree ultimately became a film. And I was initially drawn to the idea that modernist design could, in some sense, either create or negate a positive social environment. And, you know, that's a really big idea. I love movies that kind of get into those big ideas. So this idea that design was somehow crucial to the social landscape was a real draw. But I also happen to be from a town called Columbia, Missouri. It's a town of maybe 120,000, 2 hours to the west of St. Louis. And I grew up in the suburbs of St. Louis. And so, you know, with Pruitt-Igoe, here was not only a story that had this kind of huge modernist architecture and design lesson built into it, programmed into it, but also it was something that I was close to both geographically as well as kind of personally since I grew up there. And so, the idea of telling a story about the city of St. Louis, or at least a component of that city, was something I really wanted to do.
Chad, let's talk a little bit about the substance of the film. What is the myth of the film's title, and how was it dispelled?
Well, so the title actually comes from an essay by an academic called Catherine Bristol. And she wrote the article, The Pruitt-Igoe Myth, back in the 1980s. And she looked at Pruitt-Igoe in the context of the city of St. Louis overall. So she looked at the financial problems of the housing authority. She looked at the legislation that was written that created things like Pruitt-Igoe. She looked at the changing demographics of the city of St. Louis in the post-war years. So she looked at all these kinds of factors. And then she creates a kind of compelling picture of what went wrong in Pruitt-Igoe. And then at the very end, she asks a question. And this is her myth, right? This is the myth that Catherine Bristol calls the Pruitt-Igoe myth. And that is the myth that architecture was in some sense responsible for the decline of the project, right? And so then she asks a further question is, do people who utilize this myth, how are they using it? Are they using it to inflate the powers of architecture to either create good or negative social situations? And that's the conclusion that she ultimately came to in that. And so in honor of that essay, which was very influential on my thinking, I titled the film The Pruitt-Igoe Myth. But we looked at not only, we didn't really look at architecture, surprisingly enough. I know I'm on a show about architecture right now. The film isn't about architecture per se. It's about an architectural icon and perhaps a reinterpretation of that. But in the beginning of the film, we present these kind of three myths that we don't necessarily directly confront, but we at least kind of have hovering in the background. At least if you're from America, and certainly if you're from St. Louis, you know some of these. So the first myth is that architecture was the problem. The second myth that is common and surrounded projects like Pruitt-Igoe all through its years was that public welfare and assistance programs were the problem, right? They were the scapegoat. And this is what happens when you attempt to spend large amounts of money on poor people. They just tear it up, right? It's just a waste of money. And I suspect that this conversation has come up in the UK as well. It's not specific to America. But then if you go to the city of St. Louis itself, a story that you'll commonly hear is that it's the residents that were the problem. The residents were gifted this grand new project and they tore it up, right? And so what we tried to do in the film was not directly attempt to refute those, but we tried to present a new argument kind of in the spirit of Catherine Bristol's earlier analysis of the city of St. Louis, put Pruitt-Igoe in its context and illustrate the lives that regular people led within this project with an idea of getting a more complicated picture of something that had been vastly oversimplified before.
And tell me a little bit, Chad, finally, about your method for making the film, because I know it's comprised mainly of archive footage. Was it difficult to put the film together? Working with archives is notoriously tricky in the world of film.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably why the reason why it took so many years was the archival elements of it. You know, when we started out, I had no idea what this film was going to look like. I had no idea how to operate with archival materials. I just knew there would be interviews, and that's about it. So once we got the interviews, started to get edited together maybe a year in, we decided, okay, well, we got to fill these gaps up with visuals, and that's when we turned to archival. There are a lot of resources in the United States for locating films. So one of the big, you know, things you have to do is go find things. Fortunately, we had the Missouri History Museum here in the city of St. Louis that had a lot of the materials that you see in the film. We went to public libraries. We got films on interlibrary loan. We talked, of course, to stock footage houses or news organizations and whatnot to locate the films. And I don't know if that's it's not a particularly interesting answer, but it's very true. I mean, you just go to a lot of different sources, you try to track things down, and then you figure out ways to incorporate the things that you do find into a coherent story, you know? And so that's just kind of the way they all go, I think. You just kind of try to pull together as much as you can and make it work.
That was Chad Fredericks, director of the Pruitt-Igoe Myth. You can find out more information about the film and order a copy at pruittigoe.com. That's PRUITT-IGOE.com. Often, discussions about design in feature films focus on set design, backdrops, textures, furnishings, and outfits that lay the foundations upon which the action takes place. But now we're going to turn our attention to an often overlooked piece of cinematic furniture, the opening title sequence. Though less and less common, title sequences can be a powerful tool for setting the mood of a film. Ben Ryland is the presenter of the cinema show here on Monocle 24. We asked him to choose his favourite title sequence, to which he replied, "There can only be one, 1978's Superman."
In the decade of the 1930s, even the great city of Metropolis was not spared the ravages of the worldwide depression. In the times of fear and confusion, the job of informing the public was the responsibility of the Daily Planet, a great metropolitan newspaper whose reputation for clarity and truth had become a symbol of hope for the city of Metropolis.
A pair of sepia-toned curtains have just parted to reveal a spinning globe atop New York's magnificent Daily News building as we effortlessly glide from our seats towards the screen and, quite literally, into the film itself. With the Earth a distant glimmer just behind us, we're now hurtling through space. Strange orbs and glowing specks fly past at enormous speed, and then, with a great whoosh, the opening credits rush directly for us, etched in icy blue. You can almost feel the wind as they fly right over our heads. And then a red glow creeps in, and with another almighty whoosh, make no mistake, we're at the movies. If I were to pick my favourite opening to a film, it would have to be this one from Superman the Movie, starring Christopher Reeve and released in 1978. It's a perfect blend of special effects extravagance and musical brilliance, and that also acts as a bridge between the worlds of production design and the more traditional fields of typography and graphic design. Importantly, however, in the case of Superman at least, it very cleverly crafts an unquenchable thirst in the audience for something more. And as the lush score takes us deeper into space, everything takes a darker turn as we touch down on the planet Krypton. This is a film that understands the power of anticipation better than almost any other. It takes a full 40 minutes for Superman to even appear on the screen. The now legendary opening sequence was designed by Richard Greenberg, using a process in CinemaScope similar to the slit scan effect used for 2001, A Space Odyssey. Although Greenberg actually had to invent his from scratch. Remember, this is long before computer-generated imagery. Everything had to be an optical effect. Of course, some title sequences are best remembered not for their complex visuals, but for their ingenious use of simplicity. The title sequence for Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho uses a basic set of sharp, animated lines intersecting with the credits, which appear to break and splinter at certain points during Bernard Herrmann's iconic theme. This is the work of Saul Bass, one of the most celebrated artists in the history of cinema, and the mastermind behind many famed opening sequences. His career is more proof for how intimate the wider world of design can be with the fictional fantasies of the screen. Bass was also an accomplished graphic designer in the corporate world, devising logos for companies such as Continental Airlines, Quaker Oats, and United Airlines. Of course, there was very rarely any ambiguity about who was behind a Saul Bass title sequence. From Vertigo in 1958, Ocean's 11 in 1960, and the excellent political drama Advice and Consent in 1962. His work always carried a particular look that would lure viewers into the world carefully constructed for their enjoyment, or their torment, or perhaps both.
What is love without the giving?
It seems like such a simple concept now, but Bass's idea was quite revolutionary for Hollywood films. By following that lead and using the opening sequence as a sort of mood board, films like Imitation of Life from 1959 by the legendary director Douglas Sirk laid out a scene of diamonds raining down behind handwritten credits, while Earl Grant sung the title theme.
Without love, there's so much duller.
A perfect introduction to a story about the destructive powers of American decadence. Surprisingly few of today's films carry the clever influence of Saul Bass, Douglas Sirk, or Superman director Richard Donner, without falling into the trap of pastiche. Misguided ideas of what constitutes realism too often leave us with simple text rudely populating the first few scenes of the film, or, in some cases, nothing at all. There are exceptions, of course. Tom Ford's Nocturnal Animals features one of the most striking title sequences in memory, perhaps unsurprisingly, coming from the mind of one of the world's leading designers. As you're jittering about in a darkened cinema, searching for your cup holder and trying to get a good handful of popcorn, the commanding presence of the film ought to snap you to attention. You should feel as though you're feasting on something spectacular that's somehow only making you hungrier. As the great Saul Bass said, this is all about making the ordinary extraordinary. This is the movies. For Monocle, I'm Ben Rylan.
Monocle 24's Ben Rylan there on the art of title sequence design. You can hear more of Ben on The Cinema Show. Listen live every Friday at 20:00 London time or explore the back catalogue at monocle.com. This week's episode will include an interview with the production designer of Tom Ford's latest film, Nocturnal Animals. Don't miss it. The growth of film for a mass audience gave rise to a whole new type of building, the cinema. The Nickelodeon in Pittsburgh may have been the first building exclusively devoted to showing movies. But the first ever public screening of a film, a silent short, by the Skladanowski brothers, was shown in Berlin's Wintergarten Theatre. And since then, the German-speaking world has cultivated a proud tradition of movie theatres, or as they call them, Kino. Vienna Design Week celebrated its 10th anniversary a few weeks ago with an impressive show of contemporary design, architecture and crossover projects. And among the exhibitions was one that asked the audience to engage with the cinema as a design object. Monocle's Alexei Korolev paid a visit.
This is the office of the Diagonale Film Festival in central Vienna. Complete with all the trappings of a regular cinema, it's the setting of an installation called Cinéma Jarry, part of Vienna Design Week, brought to life by a team of four creatives.
I'm Victoria Schmid. I'm a filmmaker and artist.
I'm Lena Gold. I'm also artist and designer.
My name is Johan Lurf. I'm an artist and filmmaker.
I'm David Tauter. I'm an architect and industrial designer.
There are 10 or so people in the auditorium with me, and together we watch transfixed as a host of analog projectors beam through crystals and glassware from the iconic Austrian glassmaker Lobmeier to create patterns all around us.
So the crystals are rotating on kind of...
Disco motors.
Yeah, disco motors. Oh, right. In front of the projectors. How did you...
Yeah, we needed something to...
To rotate.
Yeah. And with the crystals, you have more prismatic effects. Although Johan and Victoria already had lenses
from cameras. Or lenses you use to have special effects when you take photos to split up the image.
All of the things came together as a collaborative thing. So we discussed how can we create some motion, some sound, reflection for this evening. And by using the analog material, we had the chance to create sound with patterns that were designed by David. This was just one part of the idea, and then the other ideas came in with the crystals and moving parts.
It's quite interesting to think about it because it was a long process of four minds and four ideas and four different people, and it's a group effort, which we all appreciate.
Yeah, actually, first the room was here, maybe, and then we decided to use the room and not go somewhere else.
Then for me, it's normal to use 60mm film. It's my main medium. But then it was Johan who said, let's use analog projectors and analog film. So we decided on that. And then it was really we met and we shared ideas and we thought about cinema. And so we came up with this.
This project is part of a phenomenon known as expanded cinema. The term was coined in the mid-1960s to describe a subversive new type of cinema that challenged the traditional conventions of spectatorship, encouraging the viewer to engage directly with image and sound. But unlike some of the original expanded cinema experiments, which often had a political message, Cinéma Jarry is concerned with the cinema space itself, its design and architecture. Its goal is to turn it into a Lichtspiel, play of light.
We saw different patterns in different sizes, projected by different projectors, alternating, overlapping, side by side, and the image was also destroyed, distorted by the objects. So not only the screen is illuminated, also the cinema space. There is a lot of thoughts in it, and the purpose of creating an art piece is to let the art speak. So I think there are different meanings in different heads. Mm-hmm. That's the main goal of creating something, I think.
Sure, but
To trigger thoughts.
What was the one in your head?
In my head was to think about the cinema space, not let the people go in and out during the screening, think about all these rules that the cinema gives us and we not think about it.
It's a mix of all the old traditions that are out there and, of course, our approach and each individual's ideas together.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
It's nearly time to wrap up this week's show, but before we do, we're going to take a look at how filmmakers have used architecture and how architects have used film in their practice. James Taylor Foster is the European Editor-at-Large at architecture website Arc Daily. He joined us to impart his wisdom on this topic. He began by telling me about a few films where architecture is more than just set dressing.
There's an interesting case this year, High Rise, which was, of course, a dystopian novel by J.G. Ballard. And it sort of follows the rise and demise of the residents of a tall, brutalist concrete tower. Not entirely sure where, but it certainly has a feeling towards London. There's an architect called Royal, who sits at the top of this tower and describes his design as being the sort of crucible for change. But societally speaking, obviously, the pecking order manifests itself as a hierarchy, with the upper classes occupying the top levels. He himself, as I mentioned, resides in this sort of penthouse and has turned the roof into a country house garden as a folly for his wife. And there are many parallels between this and the way, for example, architect Erno Goldfinger took an apartment at the top of the Belfont Tower in London, which was his kind of brutalist masterpiece.
You built all this.
I put all my energies into this tower,
but I am the architect of my own accident.
Is that a horse?
Probably.
On the 40th floor.
Your husband appears intent on colonizing the sky.
And who can blame him when you look at what's going on at street level?
I think you really have to look to Alfred Hitchcock, who was, you know, a master of so many things, but a master of scenography and interiors and architecture. Architecture manufactured sort of especially to work with the narrative of his films. Think of Rear Window, in which a whole apartment block and a street beyond was physically constructed at full scale to accommodate the story. Or what he was quite known for, single set films, like Rope, in which an apartment interior was carefully designed to allow for the movie to be filmed in, I think, one or two continuous takes. Think to his more famous film, Psycho, which is essentially a motel and a house on a hill being the set. The architectures are utterly integral to the films themselves, and you can even extend this further into the realms of kind of architectural popularization and creation. North by Northwest is particularly interesting in this front because Hitchcock actually created an astonishingly contemporary house in the film's final scenes. This kind of vast, highly modern building with a contemporary cantilever and what you would describe in architectural terms as prairie-style interiors. These were all inspired by the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, who was at the time one of the United States' more innovative architects. Interestingly, though, this was never built full scale. It was built as a model. And if you jump five decades later to 2014, you have Wes Anderson in, I think, one of his most famous films, The Grand Budapest Hotel, in which he as a director really starts to play with the ambiguity of scale that architecture and set design affords. You know, real spaces and interiors are complemented by models, which are clearly models, but are at times fantastically realistic and give Anderson a sort of freedom to create scenes which would otherwise require CGI. And, you know, I mean, I think this should be seen really as an evolution of Hitchcock's methods, but something which is more tactile and more architectural simply because it has a kind of craft to it.
That was James Taylor Foster, Editor-at-Large for architecture website Arc Daily. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a line at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, please leave us a review. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan, and until next time, it's goodbye from me.